Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Tuesday, December 9th, welcome, 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 friends, on Into the Show. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. It's cold outside.
It is.
It's really cold. It's 30 degrees. Do you know how much that is in Celsius? Top of your head.
No.
Do you know how to solve for that, generally?
Generally, maybe.
Yeah.
If I thought about it.
You have to do some addition, some subtraction, some fractions, or you could ask our German producer, Andreas. That would be the easy
Probably
way.
Knows
or
that,
Or ChatGPT.
Yeah.
But I bring all this up because the way to convert Fahrenheit to Celsius is pretty simple if you know the formula.
Mm-hmm.
But it involves some math that apparently some students entering college, are not prepared to do.
Ooh.
According to this viral new report from a college out in California, which suggested that some students entering college have legitimate struggles with things like rounding numbers and fractions. And it spawned a lot of worry about how prepared students are for college today. Now, that worry could be overblown, or it could be the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
And today we're going to talk about it. How prepared are students to enter college, specifically when it comes to doing basic mathematics? And our question for you is this. Is Gen Z prepared for college? If not, what, or perhaps who, is to blame? 888-477-9499. Would love to hear from teachers and students today. The email is studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
Yeah, and it makes you even wonder. Like, I have not used that skill in so long.
Yeah.
The conversion of Fahrenheit to Celsius. That, you know, you think about all the math skills that I gained in high school and college. Because I'm a journalist and I work in this field, I haven't used a lot of it.
Sure.
So, and you wonder, do they need to know this high-level algebra?
Well, one
One
reason I brought that one particularly up is because it's the type of thing that's so easy to query now online. Like, I just did it in 2 seconds.
And you got the
answer.
30
degrees is minus 1.111 Celsius, right?
That sounds
right. Anyone could do that in a matter of seconds.
Yeah.
Even 20, 30 years ago, you
had to know the math. Yeah.
You had to maybe have some basic knowledge, right? Mm-hmm. And so as part of the explanation here that people are just finding technological workarounds that elide the basic mathematics, or perhaps there's other explanations, the pandemic, et cetera. Some people think it's great inflation. We're going to talk about all of it today.
Yeah. Again, 888-477-9499. The email studio2@whyy.org. Is Gen Z prepared for college? If not, what or who is to blame?
Also, why is it so cold? If you have thoughts on that, studio2@whyy.org.
All right. Our trio of news story. The top story, President Donald Trump, as you might have heard, will be in Pennsylvania later today as part of his first stops on his national affordability tour. He'll be in both Scranton and then Mount Pocono areas of the Commonwealth, where Trump did pretty well and where Republicans need to win in the 2026 midterms in order to keep control of the U.S. House. The focus of his message is expected to be affordability and gas prices as the president tries to promote his economic agenda and, you know, his efforts to lower inflation. A November Gallup poll found that 40% of Americans rated economic conditions as poor. This is up from 37% in October. And a Fox News national survey found that 70+% of voters view the economy negatively. And, you know, President Donald Trump has been saying that, you know, inflation is a scam, that the economy is doing great. And he blames, you know, former President Joe Biden for a lot of what's happening. But folks are like, no.
Yeah, the polls aren't good.
Groceries are higher than they were. And this is no longer Biden's fault. So now, you know, he's going to do what he does best, which is hit the road and talk directly to his base.
Do you think people blame shift faster now from one administration to the next than they used to? Like, I wonder if the grace period for a new administration has gotten shorter or not. And I don't have any data on this. There's always been some backsliding in the first year, but unless there's an like unusual event like 9/11 or something, but there's always been some backsliding in the first year. But I do wonder if the speed of like a voter's attention span shift is like,
I definitely think on this particular issue, the patience of voters was very thin.
To begin with.
Yeah, to begin with.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, President Donald Trump was on the road promising, you know, he would do things so fast. And I think it wasn't happening fast enough. So people lost patience.
Yeah. Just curious.
Yeah. I don't know. That's my thought.
That's
an
interesting analysis. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think my thought was that campaigns are so negative now, mm-hmm. and people say, like, this person who's in power now is so dumb and so bad and so corrupt. We'll get in there and we'll clean it up. And people's maybe expectations have changed as a result of how campaigning works, or it could just be something Trump specific, or it could be issue specific. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. Story number two. This is an interesting one out of Philly with legal implications for when and how police can be held accountable for their actions. So this story that we're going to talk about tracks back to 2020, when a pair of Philadelphia police officers saw a man that they suspected of dealing drugs in Kensington.
Yeah.
The police, as they often do, pursued the suspect. The suspect drove away, at first at a pretty normal speed, then much faster. And eventually this suspect rammed his car into a mother of four and killed her. Now, the suspect has been convicted of third-degree murder, no surprise. The question in this case was, could the family of the slain woman also sue the police officers for their part in this incident? A lower court judge said yes, the case could proceed to civil court and to a jury. Mm-hmm. But the news is that the U.S. Third Circuit Court of Appeals, based here in Philadelphia, just reversed that ruling in a recent decision and said the police cannot be held liable for their actions.
Yeah. It's so interesting because this is a tragic case. You have a mother of four minding her business killed because of a car chase. And you have policies in the Philadelphia Police Department that say you're not supposed to chase. But here, the estate wanted to sue the police officers in their individual capacities. And the court said, no, you can't do that. And there's a thing called qualified immunity that under the law, officers are not constitutionally liable for injuries unless their judgments are not just mistakes, but they're egregious and shocking to the conscience. They have a much higher level. And in this case, the court said, look, they weren't intending to hurt this woman or anybody else. But the Inquirer reporting stood out to me because it's been expensive. These chases. I mean, the city has spent, what, $20 million last year settling cases because
related
of
to chases.
Injuries that happened to chases. This is there's a real reason why you're not supposed to chase, because somebody does get hurt.
Absolutely. Story number three on the topic of money, but a very different money topic. Go ahead, Jerry.
Pennsylvania raked in over $1 billion last year in taxes on, get this, digital casinos, you know, slot machines you can play on your cell phone or online. Cha-ching, cha-ching. Yes, that's more than five times the amount Pennsylvania takes in from sports betting, by the way. And at $1.05 billion, pretty significant amount of revenue when you consider that the state budget is $50 billion, okay? Great story by the New York Times. It explains that the Commonwealth taxes digital casinos at a higher rate than sports betting, but people also tend to lose a whole lot more using these online casinos. Why? Because you can play on the toilet. You can play laying in the bed.
You can lose a lot of money on the toilet.
A lot of money on the toilet, man.
A lot.
And while Pennsylvania has earned the most revenue off online casinos, it's not the only state that is raking in that kind of money. I mean, seven states collected a total of $2.1 billion last year. New Jersey brought in about $50 million a month, Avi.
I think what stands out to me is that there's a lot of consternation, rightly so, about sports gambling.
Yeah.
I think in part because there's a scandal element to that, you know, where the players might affect the outcomes. There's also just a lot of visibility around sports gambling right now. There's so much advertising. And what it obscures is the fact that the much bigger industry is online casinos and those little games you play on your phone. Yes, sports gambling gets a lot of headlines, but if you want to look at where lots of folks are really losing their shirt right now, it's with these apps and basically taking a slot machine and putting it on your phone. And like we were joking about the toilet thing, but that's really the heart of it. The fact that you don't have to go anywhere. You can live in a rural community. You don't need to live near a casino anymore to bet lots and lots of money.
And people are literally losing they're getting cars repossessed. They are getting eviction notices because they're losing tens of thousands of dollars. And these are not rich people losing their shirts.
But now it's become a tentpole source of revenue for the state. So it's hard to imagine them ever messing with that money. The state needs that money. This is an amazing stat. In Pennsylvania, the state collected more tax revenue from online casinos than physical lottery tickets for the first time last fiscal year.
Wow.
I mean, lottery's been around forever. Lots of people.
But you got to get up and you got to go buy a lottery ticket.
But it's already surpassed that already.
Yeah.
And look, it's a complicated issue. We can parse it lots of ways. But I do think it raises some alarms for me.
But the number one call now to the gambler's hotline is for folks doing this online gambling. And people are calling this a money grab by the government.
Yeah. I think it's a fair critique.
Yeah.
I do think it's complicated because the revenue is very much needed in the state budget. But at the same time, we talk a lot about sports gambling and there are real issues there. But there are real issues here as well.
Maybe need to do a show.
Also, issues maybe around how prepared students are for college these days. We're going to talk about it on the other side of this break. Don't go anywhere. And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. The Gen Z American student population has not had it easy. They've had to grapple with classroom culture wars and a global pandemic. They're the first cohort to have to manage the addicting influences of smartphones, and now they have to deal with AI.
Hand-wringing about college preparedness is nothing new. In September, the nation's report card released data indicating that a large portion of 12th graders lack basic proficiency in reading and math. But a new wave of worry took hold recently when UC San Diego, a highly ranked, selective university, released a report. It found that in the last 5 years, the number of incoming students with below middle school level math skills increased by a factor of 30.
Yeah, today we're going to unpack this math problem. And here to join us is Matt Barnum. Matt has covered K-12 education for The Wall Street Journal and Chalkbeat. And he recently started his own column for Chalkbeat devoted to explaining and examining the ideas and debates shaping American schools. Matt, thank you so much for being on Studio 2.
Thanks for having me. Thrilled to be here.
And we would be thrilled to hear from you listening right now. Do you think Gen Z is prepared for college? If not, what's to blame? We would love to hear from college students and teachers today, especially. Give us a call, 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org, YouTube, Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
And so, Matt, we wanted to start with this UC San Diego report. I mean, it kind of blew up, and I saw all this talk online about this. Could you tell us what the report found, and then give us your take on why people reacted so strongly?
The report was a committee from the faculty and administrators at UC San Diego, and it said that there was an alarming rise in the number of students at the school that needed remedial math, like basic math, like middle school math or even lower. And they said there was been a large increase in the number of students who needed that. Now, it's a large increase from a very low base. It's still, you know, I think about 10% of students who are in the lowest level remedial math. But it was a shocking increase to this committee for a selective school where presumably most kids are doing well, or at least it seemed like that, and they were getting good grades. I think it blew up on the internet because to critics, it represented something much bigger. To them, they saw it as equity efforts run amok because California had recently gotten rid of standardized test scores in college admissions, and also an alarming decline in learning and standards in K-12 schools.
So let's try to start to sort hype from reality here.
Right.
How much of this is specific to one school with some changing criteria around admissions? And what part of this do you see as a type of canary in the coal mine, like actually indicative of some larger trend in American education?
I think generally it's indicative of something alarming, which is we have seen very real learning declines. Since the pandemic and even before, there were declines in test scores on math and reading tests, the National Assessment of Educational Progress. And that's like bad. We want kids to graduate knowing how to do basic math and how to read. So there's very real reason to be alarmed about that. Now, I think some of the descriptions of this have been a touch overstated, you know, but depends on the test you look at. Sometimes it's like we're at early 2000s levels of achievement. Sometimes we're at like 1990s levels of achievement. It's not like we're going back to the dark ages. It's not like we're going back, worse than any generation before.
I just want to stop you there because people inevitably are going to and are already calling in talking about the good old days of 50, 60 years ago. So just looking at like NAEP scores, that's the test you referenced. This, I believe, is for 13-year-olds in math. In 1973, they started rolling this assessment out. The average scaled score was 266. It peaked at 285 in 2012. And now it's down to 271. Like you said, 271, obviously much worse than 285, but above 266 in 1973. So there had been some progress over time, and now we've seen a slip back. I just want to put that out there for folks who are starting to call and comment and talk about maybe what was going on 50 years ago. Just keep that in mind.
Yeah. And by the way, I wanted to mention that researchers and some educators, they said that there had been this perfect storm, sort of like a mix of forces, the pandemic, chronic absenteeism, optional test scores, and also these declines. Can you talk about it? Do you agree that there was like this sort of, all these things sort of, colliding at the same time with this cohort of students?
I think that's probably right. What we haven't fully wrapped our head around what all the things are. We know definitely that COVID had a negative effect. There's rigorous studies showing that, kids who lost schooling during COVID, of course, have fallen behind. There's a lot of theories about screens in schools, and screens outside of schools. I don't know that we've sort of proven that that's a causal factor behind the learning declines, but it's a plausible culprit, let's put it that way. There are a lot of other theories as well. There's a discussion about a shift in accountability at schools, like schools are not being held accountable for test scores, or there's a new culture of lower achievement. I think the evidence on that is just emerging, but that's another culprit. We're trying to figure out what exactly is going on. It probably was a perfect storm. We're just trying to figure out now what all the factors
were. Yeah, what are the ingredients of said storm? Let's get some comments in here. Gerardo from Philly says, too much emphasis on the right answer and not the process to get it. Actually, I want to use that as a jumping off point for a question, Matt. One thing that became a boogeyman in a lot of education circles was this idea of Common Core math or new math. There's different types of terms for it. But there was a change in how math was generally taught. It wasn't everywhere, but there was a general shift in how math was taught. And my understanding of the change is that they were trying to move away from, memorize this formula, know what to plug in and get to the right answer, trying to get to a place of, this is understand what the math is. Don't just memorize 3 times 6, but understand that 3 times 6 is taking, 3 groups of 6 or something like that. First of all, how big was that shift in teaching math? And do we know much about the results of that shift?
To directly answer your questions, I would say quite big. And no. I think under the Common Core, which were new academic standards, teachers started teaching in a different way, especially math. And I still actually hear from parents in my life who are like, wait a second, what is this weird thing that my kid is bringing, my second grader is bringing home on their homework? The actual shift in teachers' practices, we don't exactly know how big it was, but I suspect it was pretty substantial. We don't have a ton of research on exactly how, believe it or not, that has changed, achievement trends, in part because it was rolled out to so many places all at once, so it's hard to study.
Yeah. By the way, I want to invite our listeners at home, on the road, and elsewhere to join the conversation. Our questions of the day are, is Gen Z prepared for college? If not, what or who is to blame? We want to hear from college students and teachers. The number is 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, leave your comments in the chat. We have Alita from Pottstown on the line. Alita, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi there. I just wanted to make a comment, and I know I need to keep it within 30 seconds, but I have a master's degree in secondary math, taught a few years in the regular public school system, but substituted for numerous years. Middle schoolers don't know their basic facts. That could go to other NPRs that I've listened to and written on about working memory versus long-term memory and why it is important to memorize those basic multiplication facts. But the one thing I wanted to bring up was one of the papers that I wrote studied the PISA and the TIMSS exams, which is given at eighth grade internationally. And what I found was a correlation between foreign language and math at an early age, meaning you teach foreign language, a second language, in the elementary school level. A lot of the data that comes from the United States is biased because it studies those English as a second language learners, who many of which come from poverty. So we can't really use that data. It's very biased. So what I dug into is, does it have to do with, oh, everybody has to learn English? No. Ireland teaches Gaelic at a very low age. They always beat us in that score, in that, those tests.
Mm-hmm.
Canada, I used as an example, because mm-hmm. in Quebec has to learn French and English at mm-hmm. a low elementary school level. Singapore, even in preschool, but Canada specifically, because Quebec is the only one that requires French and English yeah. at a low grade yeah. level.
So I think, just to summarize, Alita, in the interest of time,
we got to cut it down.
And I know yeah. you're passionate about really this topic. I think it's, you're saying Canada? that there's a correlation she feels between teaching foreign language and promoting other types of basic knowledge and skills. Interesting theory, but I guess one thing that does bring up, Matt, is how America is doing compared to other nations. We've been talking mm-hmm. about this thing called the Nation's Report Card, the NAEP. That's a test that's only administered here. There are tests that are administered right. all over the world, and how has America's ranking in math, how does it compare to other yeah. similar countries? Is it changing over time? And I don't know if you probably don't have the numbers exactly right in front of you, but general trend lines would be great.
Yeah. And so basically, my takeaway about the U.S. in comparison to other countries is we're not great, but we're not as bad as the conventional wisdom would have you believe. Yeah. The conventional wisdom is that the U.S. is so awful in education compared to the rest of the world. And, you know, that hasn't actually really been the case, and it isn't the case now. And lots of other countries have also seen declines on test scores recently. Sometimes the U.S. declines are a bit worse, but actually sometimes they're a bit less. So it sort of nets out, like, this is actually an international problem, which suggests, you know, that's more consistent, for instance, with the screens hypothesis.
Right. It's like, what changed around the world all right. at once? You could say the mm-hmm. pandemic. The pandemic yeah. hit lots right. of different countries, but the screens would be the other one.
Exactly. Yeah.
And by the way, Michael comments, I took remedial math in college. I took advantage of the math lab during my years in college. I graduated on time. Taking remedial math class is not the kiss of death. Michael says, every incoming freshman will not be on the same academic level. Just reality. You actually wrote about this, that, you know, a lot of these kids, I mean, they're coming in, they all have this different level, but they end up doing better, even if they're in remedial math, because they went to UC San Diego. Can you walk us through your argument on that?
Yeah.
And what are the outcomes? Because people are sounding these alarms, but this is still one of the top, 10, 15, 20 schools, top eight public universities. When you think about kids getting into schools like this, even though they're in remedial math, what is the outcome?
The University of California, San Diego report argues that they should just not let in kids who need remedial math. And they should also scale back the number of students from high poverty public high schools in California. That is one way to solve the problem from the university's perspective, but it doesn't solve the problem of kids needing extra help. And, you know, there's a theory out there that, well, if we let kids in who need extra help and they're behind their peers, they're going to suffer. We're setting them up for failure to let them into these selective universities. But researchers have studied that, and they actually find the opposite, that kids who are just on the margin of getting in, even if they're not the academic superstars, even if they're behind their peers, they tend to benefit from going to more resource, more selective universities like the University of California, San Diego. So I think your commenter is spot on that getting remedial math can actually help kids learn. We all want our high schools and our elementary and middle schools to do better. But the question for colleges is, when that doesn't happen for everyone, what do they do? Do they just screen those kids out? Or do they try to help them learn more?
Yeah, what's your function as an institution of higher education and learning? Is it to help lift kids up who need the help? Or is it just to screen them all out and pat yourself on the back and say, we're doing great, no one's in remedial math? It's a fascinating query. Let me bring in another caller now. This is Vita, I believe, from Doylestown on line two. You're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment or insight?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My comment as a former middle school math teacher is simply the kids don't know math, even going back to middle school. They count on their fingers, and on tests, they're allowed to use calculators. So it's a no-win situation for those kids. We really should be going back to elementary school, where I had to stand in my fourth grade class and do all my math times tables, and I knew it by the time I got to middle school, and high school was a breeze. So I think that that's where we're failing.
Mm. Thank you, Vita from Doylestown.
I like that call. Let's bring in another caller here. Mm-hmm. Here's John from Allentown on line four. John's got a theory, I think, for us. John, you're on Studio 2. What do you got?
Yeah, I do think this is a canary in the cave, a big problem looming. And I think that has an awful lot to do with grade inflation. Grade inflation originally started, they say, back around the Vietnam War, when college professors were keeping kids, giving kids higher grades so they could avoid the draft, wanting to not accept the responsibility for life and death changes in their students' lives. And I think that every time that we have a major crisis point in society, society and education tends to lighten the standards. The pandemic would be a good example. The pandemic happened. It caused a lot of upheaval. And then, of course, you know, administrators were telling professors, you know, go easy on the grades or just do pass fails. And so, you know, I think this is a pattern that's happened over time and is contributing very strongly to these reports that are just now starting to emerge.
Yeah, yeah, thank you so much.
Common theme in both those calls would be a sort of worry about rigor. And specifically grade inflation there with John. Grade inflation, I would imagine, just a very tricky thing to quantify. Have there been attempts out there, Matt, to quantify how prevalent grade inflation is in the K-12 space and whether it is growing?
Yeah, there have been some efforts, and I mean the best way to some states and a couple national studies have shown that grades have been trending up for many years now. And that's not necessarily evidence of grade inflation. Kids could be learning more and their grades are going up. But we actually know recently that kids are not learning more. They're learning less. Mm-hmm. And we're also seeing high school graduation rates continue to trend up, or at least not decline. And that's also potentially evidence of grade inflation. And so we see this sort of one-way ratchet of grades going up in the context when students don't seem to be learning more. And I think that's a totally legitimate concern. And it's understandable at the teacher or school level why they're doing this. You know, they don't want to deny a kid a diploma, say. But I do think that can lead to lower expectations, which can harm all students.
Yeah. And now we want to hear from a math professor who is teaching college students to find out what they're seeing in classrooms today and how it's changed. We have Maria Loren. She's a professor of instruction in mathematics at Temple University, and she joins us now. Maria, welcome to Studio 2.
Hi, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And so I want to, you know, get your reaction because I know you've heard about that UC San Diego report. You know, what was your reaction when you heard that report land? What, if anything, surprised you or what felt familiar?
So I have to say, sadly, a lot of it felt very familiar. I was not terribly surprised seeing a lot of those findings. For me, though, the nice thing about seeing that report land was that that very respectable school, University of California at San Diego, was publishing this publicly. And it really, I feel like, opens up the freedom for the rest of us to have honest conversations about what's going on our own campuses. Hmm. And for us to realize we're not alone. This is like a national problem.
Yeah. Yeah. So are you seeing similar gaps in basic math skills among your students at Temple?
We are seeing a lot of those same things, absolutely.
And when did you start noticing this?
So I think that the instructors in our department have been noticing a creep for quite a few years, 5, 6, 7 years. But in the last few, it's really become so big that the rest of the campus is really catching on and taking notice.
Yeah. How does it change your job as an instructor when you have to try to catch students up at the very beginnings of their college careers? Like, how much time is diverted in that effort, and what else is affected when you are diverting that time and that effort?
So there are a lot of things. So this semester I'm teaching Calculus 1, and there we have to spend more time reviewing prerequisite skills, and as a result, we end up dropping some topics, some things that might be considered, you know, a little bit more optional so that we can address those kinds of things. But for a lot of incoming students, they're placing well below Calculus, and they have a long road to catch up to even make it to Calculus. So we're having to train instructors to try to teach that group of students. They're basically learning middle school level or Algebra 1 level mathematics. This is a long road for students, and for our department, our resources are heading more toward those developmental courses and away from some of our other major courses.
Yeah. And so when you hear about this, I mean, we've talked about this perfect storm. There are so many things that have been reasons why and factors into leading us to this place. What would you say are some of the factors that you think have left your students sort of lacking, you know, some of the basic skills they need to take classes like yours?
Yeah, so there are a lot of things there. For sure, the pandemic has played a big role, in my opinion. Other things that I would conjecture, but I'm less certain about, things like we no longer require SATs here at Temple. It's test optional. That may be playing some role in what we're seeing. I'm not certain. Also, the things that I know you were just talking about, some grade inflation at high schools before I got on. So all of those things, again, I'm not quite expert on those things, but I would conjecture that they are having an impact too.
Before we let you go, look, there's a lot of this that folks at Temple can't control. Like the pandemic would be an obvious one. In many ways, you can't control the proliferation of screens and phones. I mean, you have some control over that, but not a ton. Given what you can control, what do you see as some solutions or some way that you can at least streamline the process so that your remediation is as effective as possible?
Yeah, so we have been working on things for several years now, and it's still a work in progress because, like I said, it's, you know, not just the department, but the university at large that's really taking notice of this now. So we have some like co-requisite courses for students to take, sort of support courses for our lower level math courses to give students extra support. Our Student Success Center is now running during the semester math foundations sessions where they go over basic, really basic skills for mathematics. We're hoping to maybe have a math center here where we get instructors who are particularly trained in teaching the kinds of things that that our students really need. And that's not necessarily what a lot of our PhD mathematicians are really strong at teaching. So we're doing a lot of things, I think, to try to meet the students where they're at. But it's a challenge because as everything we do, the problem just keeps getting worse and worse. So it's hard to keep up with it, I'd say.
Thank you so much, Maria Lorenz, for your time today on Studio 2.
Great take.
Fantastic insights. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
That was Maria Lorenz, professor of instruction in mathematics at Temple University. We still have Matt Barnum on the line from Chalkbeat. Lots of calls and comments.
Yeah, we're going to get to you.
Stay tuned. This is Studio 2. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We're talking about college preparedness. A recent report from UC San Diego called attention to the large numbers of incoming freshmen struggling to do basic math. And with us, we have Matt Barnum, a longtime education reporter.
And we want to hear from you, especially if you're in school or you work in schools. Do you think Gen Z is prepared for college? If not, what's to blame? 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org or drop a comment in the chat on YouTube or Facebook.
Yeah, I want to read this comment. Susan says, no one has mentioned screens with exclamation points. This is the TikTok generation, she says. Some plugged in from the time they could hold a phone. Let's bring in Scott from Somerville, who's been on the line. Scott, you're on Studio 2. What's your take?
Yes, hi. So my daughter's 10, and she struggles quite a bit with math. And we're in a good school district. It's a blue ribbon school district. And certainly COVID was the catalyst, I believe, for her learning, struggles with math. And also the advent of games like Roblox. It's a struggle for us when she gets home for her to dedicate time to her math when she wants to get on the computer and do Roblox. And there's a lot of time, an inordinate amount of time spent on games like Roblox and other forms of social media. So, and that's on us as parents. But I do think that, in our school districts, the kids switch from one school to the next. Like when you go from fourth to fifth grade, you go to another building, another school, and then from seventh to eighth, you go to another building and so forth. So when she was younger, they had dedicated staff that was able to work with her one-on-one to help her with some of the foundational concepts in math. But then when she went to another school, to the intermediate middle school, they really didn't seem to have the staffing, and you have to apply. You have mm-hmm. to meet certain criteria to be eligible to have that one-on-one tutoring and counseling for math. So, basically – what it seems like to me is like the can has been essentially kicked down the road each year. Mm-hmm. Like she does just enough to pass, but then she still is not well versed in mathematical foundational concepts. And I think that's critical. If kids are not versed in those foundational concepts at an early age, and if they can't master those foundational concepts, the can will keep getting kicked down the road.
And it just gets worse.
Thank you so much, Scott from Somerville. That goes back to something we talked about earlier, mm-hmm. Matt. How much of this is technology related? How much do we blame technology, screen time, et cetera? You've said earlier, it's murky, it's not clear, but because we have seen declines across the world, there is some sense that maybe that's one of the driving factors. Is that a fair summary of what you told us earlier?
I think that's a leading theory. I think there's good circumstantial evidence without a smoking gun. The other thing I would add, which is like a real mystery, especially, but I'm adding it because Scott mentioned his daughter. We've seen bigger learning declines since the pandemic for girls compared to boys. Mm. Mm-hmm. And no one knows why that is. And there are a few theories, but, none of them are particularly compelling. You know, maybe it's something about social media impacting girls more, but we see that we see these declines in earlier grades. So the fact that girls have been hit harder is just like a disturbing societal-wide phenomenon that we should keep in mind and also maybe could help us understand what is going on more broadly. Hmm.
And I wanted to touch on a little bit more because I know this show, we talked about the math scores, but we've also seen that a reading crisis is sort of looming as well. Can you talk about that a little bit and give us some context and whether or not there is a connection there?
Yeah. The reading scores are not much better in terms of the trends. And actually, if anything, we've seen a little bit of recovery in math scores in recent years, whereas reading has sort of flatlined or even trended downward. And so that's another mystery. I think that's another piece of circumstantial evidence about screens.
Right.
Maybe, the fact that the trends are getting even worse in reading is consistent with the screens driving things.
I want to read this comment from Mark. It's a little long, but I think it's really interesting. Mark says, a caller mentioned that students don't know basic facts, and I agree. Part of the problem is that we live in a culture that doesn't value having a broad base of knowledge. For decades, we've been able to look up anything we want to know on our phones at any time, and AI makes finding answers even easier. In that context, there's very little incentive for anyone, students included, to fill their heads with a wide range of information. Now, let me flip that comment on its head a little bit, because we're talking about declines in quote-unquote math as if that's a stagnant thing. Mm-hmm. But it's possible that technology has, given us certain shortcuts that maybe we don't need certain foundational skills as much as we used to because we have ways of solving for them using technology, and that one thing that young people have gotten better at is using digital tools to solve a problem, math problem, reading analysis, more efficiently. And that's something maybe worth celebrating. I mean, that's a big idea to try to sort through. But I do think there is a broader question in my mind about what skills we should consider foundational and whether we need to move that target a little bit, given how fast technology is accelerating. Matt, can you help me parse through that?
I think that's exactly the right question, Avi. I'm a skeptic of that theory, though. I think you can't just Google it. Google is sometimes wrong. ChatGPT, AI, is often wrong. Actually, it's quite bad at math sometimes. You cannot know whether the source you are looking for is providing you with good information without a foundational set of knowledge. Actually, you may not even be able to Google the right thing. Right. I mean, I think we've all had circumstances where we're trying to Google something and we're struggling to find the answer, or we're seeing contradictory answers. To actually use these tools, I think there's a case that you need basic knowledge more than ever.
Mm. Yeah, a different Susan, who we talked about a Susan earlier, but a different Susan says, young people don't have even basic arithmetic abilities. Old people like me, and she's 72, who use cash, often complain about young cashiers who don't understand the magic. And she goes into some calculations that people can't calculate the exact change. She says, they always say, I've given them too much money. They return the extra cash, usually before I have the chance to tell them to input it into the register and see what happens. So a lot of basics. And so I wonder, Matt, is there a line in our schools struggling to figure out where the line is between, you know, being able to use these tools and just having basic understanding of concepts?
I think schools right now are sort of like besieged, and they're like, okay, maybe I should do something about AI. And, you know, if I'm a superintendent, maybe there's a vendor that is telling me about this exciting AI tool. And I don't know, maybe it's good and they have great numbers, but wait, should I trust them? And actually, kids need to know AI, but don't they need to know basic things? And I think like they're just trying to figure it out. And we have 13,000 very decentralized school districts that are all sort of on their own to figure that out. And, you know, I think they're struggling. I think they're moving slowly at this point, which I think is both a blessing and a curse for our school systems. We'll see how it all plays out.
Mm. Yeah. So complicated. Here's another caller, Greg from Warrington on line 5. Hey, Greg, you're on Studio 2. Would love to hear what you have to add to the conversation today.
Oh, great. Thanks. A quick question, a comment and a question. So the comment is that the Temple caller, she left out the Great Bridge program that I benefited from in 1987, because coming out of the Philly Public Schools, nothing against my teachers, but my math skills stunk. And they brought me up to speed at Temple. So
that's good. Thank you for shouting that out, Greg. I appreciate that. And you wanted to add something else as well, right?
Yeah, a quick question. Yeah. So being married to an educator, in the 2000s, I noticed a seismic shift with No Child Left Behind. Mm. And my young wife had to go relearn a bunch of stuff. So I'm wondering how that affected things now, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Oh, thank you, Greg.
Yeah, that's a huge, you've reported on this specifically, Matt. So No Child Left Behind, and I'll just try to summarize it really quickly, was basically a nationwide effort to raise standards and to hold schools accountable for poor test scores. It made testing, standardized testing, far more prevalent across the country. Much of that testing remains. It's been reined back in a bit. So there, my understanding from your reporting is some evidence that No Child Left Behind worked for raising some types of skills. Maybe it plateaued, and now there's sort of mixed signals about whether we should go back to that type of regime or not. Tell us about your reporting on NCLB, Matt.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. There's this new nostalgia among policy wonks for No Child Left Behind, because during that era, our scores were going up, particularly our math scores. They were rising really rapidly in the late 90s and then the early 2000s after No Child Left Behind was enacted. I wanted to look at whether there was evidence that No Child Left Behind was the cause of those gains. And the answer is yes, there is some evidence of that. Math scores went up because there was more pressure on schools to raise them. High school graduation rates also went up, probably for the same reason. And at the same time, there was a lot of intense backlash to No Child Left Behind. People were frustrated with too much testing. They were frustrated that things that were not on the test were ignored. And so I think that there is some like discussion of bringing back more federal accountability. at the sort of policy wonk level. And my challenge to those folks is to think about, well, how do you do it in a way that like parents, teachers, and students don't revolt? I think that's a question.
Yeah, always an important question to ask.
By the way, I want to bring in another caller. We have Heather from Chester Springs on the line. Heather, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
So I'm going to pick up with the No Child Left Behind because I'm a teacher, but I'm also a parent. So my children started like kindergarten, elementary school, right about, you know, the early 2000s. And school districts and vendors, the school districts fell victim to these vendors coming in and selling these new math programs that don't require kids to memorize their multiplication tables anymore. And so my children had what's called everyday math. There's another one called Singapore math. And I promise you, parents, we were losing our minds trying to figure out how to help these kids, our kids, do their homework at home. And everyday math is supposed to be a K through 12 program, and our district only paid for it through elementary school. So but when they got to middle school, they didn't even know their multiplication tables.
Wow.
So like the middle school teachers were having to start from scratch with these kids. And all three of my kids, my oldest actually did fairly well in math, but my other two still to this day struggle. They don't know basic math. And I'm telling you, if we just went back to good old-fashioned math and, like, you know, my dear Aunt Sally, the multiplication, division, addition, subtraction trick, I think that we would see this huge decline improve if we just got rid of these crazy math programs that cost districts millions of dollars.
Thank you so that's much. Heather from
remember
Chester
PEMDAS?
Springs.
Remember PEMDAS? That was another acronym they used to use.
I remember PEMDAS. By the way, I want to, you know, Larry from Chichester, Upper Chichester says, please ask your guests and talk about the effects of politics. Are red states doing worse than blue states? Are kids from conservative families doing worse than liberal families? People also are talking about the Department of Education that is essentially being dismantled by Trump and run by a wrestling executive. And so I wanted to sort of ask you, Matt, as we only have a few more minutes left, but just sort of where do we go from here? We hear Heather from Chester Springs saying, look, we need to go back to the old school math, you know, where you had a pencil with an eraser on there with old school paper and not all this PEMDAS and all that. So where do we go from here, especially at a time when the people who used to track how students were doing from the Department of Education, their unit has been downsized?
Yeah, I think that's the million-dollar question. And who knows? It's hard to say right now. I mean, there used to be under when there was No Child Left Behind and also under the Obama administration, there was a lot of sort of bipartisan consensus about what we as what policymakers should do to improve schools. Whether you like that consensus or not, and lots of people didn't like it, you know, a lot of politicians agreed about it. That has totally collapsed and splintered. So now you have people saying we need more federal involvement, more federal accountability, as even as the education department is being broken up, or they want to break it up even further. So we're not any closer to coming to some sort of national consensus.
Yeah. And that's something that's changed so much when I started covering education. One of the things that was so interesting about covering education is that it was one of the few areas where there actually was some bipartisan consensus and the ideological fault lines weren't so familiar. And what you're telling me, Matt, is that that's kind of gone away, which makes it much harder to think about what the path forward might look like. Or is anything emerging at the national level that people might agree on that you could predict might be part of whatever the solution is? Or is it just too muddled to even single out one or two solutions at this point?
There's a lot of interest in improved reading techniques, science of reading. There's been a discussion of southern states, particularly Mississippi and Louisiana, and a couple others that have gotten better reading results than many other states. And actually, to the point from the commenter, if anything, there's some evidence that red states have weathered the storm a bit better than blue states on average with learning loss. And some people have attributed that to more accountability in those states and more of a focus on the science of reading and grade retention. I think this is a little complicated for a number of reasons, but there's a lot of interest in that.
Mm. Well, I want to thank you so much for your time today, Matt Barnum, ideas editor at Chalkbeat. You covered a ton of ground and did
you
it
really did
really
Matt.
Just fantastically well. Matt, you don't need remedial talk show class. You're in 201, 301 at this point. Thanks, Matt.
Moving on up.
I'll take it. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Let me read this comment. Let me read this comment from Gary, who says, 30 years ago, I worked for Penn State Abington in continuing ed. It's a semester. We had non-credit courses to help with remedial math skills for students. The faculty on campus had the same issues with students not being prepared for college-level courses. It's interesting to hear similar arguments 30 years later. So part of this is evergreen. Part of it's new. And, of course, the conversation will continue. And sorry, Anoon from Collinswood. Really wanted to get you in the conversation, just did not quite have enough time.
Yes, but thank you to everybody who wrote in. This clearly struck a nerve, people writing in and commenting. We appreciate you. And thank you so much to our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel May Bryan. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, and to Al Banks and Tina Calliquet, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We'll talk to you tomorrow.